to the afternoon radio show on WGXC. This is your host, Randall Martin, and we are back for another great week of music and business, my two favorite topics. And on our first hour today, we've got some great guests. But to usher them in is my main man, Anthony Gethers, who helped me gather all these fine folks. And if you don't know, now you know he's a great bass player, a great friend. And we are here. Anthony, how you doing, man?
I'm doing well, Randall, on this cool afternoon, even though it's actually evening, but we'll call it the cool afternoon. I'll go through our list in order here. So Nicole Noor of the Black Rockers United. So Nicole, say hello.
Hey, how you doing?
Okay. And then we have Tony Berkeley, guitar player that we once played with back in the day, and we're hoping to do some more stuff in the future. And then we have Ant Hatcher. Ant Hatcher, back in the day, we did a lot of jamming over at Woodstock at the Lodge. So that's where we originally met. And there's now Ricardo Beckford. Ricardo Beckford is a manager of a band called the Oxygen Box Band, based out of Newark, Montclair, New Jersey. Ricardo, can we hear you, dude?
I don't think he's ready yet.
He's not ready yet.
We're gonna come back.
He ain't ready. We'll come back to him.
Well, you know, the nice thing is that is, you know, music is such a small world, and so, you know, we all tend to cross paths. And one of the great things about what I like to speak about in the show is, you know, that there's a lot of music out there, but, you know, the other aspects of music, especially in the Black community, when we talk about jazz, we talk about rock and roll, there's a whole musical universe and diversity out there that does not get played on the radio a lot, does not get covered a lot, and there are some great musicians out there doing it and holding it down. And so we like to celebrate all forms of music, and especially urban music in its diversity. So I'm going to actually first go to Nicole. Now, you've got a very unusual organization, and you know there's so many people that, like, I love playing rock and roll. My genre is more playing jazz, but there's rock and roll is just freeing and it's kind of wild. And you've actually dedicated your organization to this. Can you bring us up to speed?
Sure. So actually, Nate Oakley in 2006 founded Black Rockers United in Houston, Texas, because he saw that gap that you're talking about in music, in which, like, a lot of the mainstream doesn't represent artists like Ant Hatcher, you know, or Seven Dust, or, you know, like Waking Terra, Sound Barrier, like, go down the list. There's a lot of really cool artists that we felt needed the shine in the spotlight. So slowly they started filtering in and we reached out to them. And now we have like a 4,300 plus member organization, a lot of amazing talents. And I appreciate you, Anthony, for being a part of it. Like,
absolutely.
A lot of us are, you know, holding it down.
Absolutely.
Yes. I love it.
Now, when you guys first began this, I mean, me and Anthony, we talk a lot about Parliament Funkadelic and some of the early bands and that produced these perfect blends of funk and rock. And, you know, these were my formative influences. And, you know, and Anthony, you talk a lot about that when you were younger playing music that, you know, this music kind of spoke to you, and various musics kind of spoke to you. And even though it wasn't sort of the pathway that a lot of people listened to, you just kind of followed your musical heart and passions.
Yes. Well, the one thing that I identify with probably a lot of Black rockers growing up was that I had the good fortune of having a father who listened to Sabbath and heavy metal at the same time. And then my mother listened to a lot of R&B, jazz, funk, and blues. So I had the gift of having all those genres in my growing up around me. But unfortunately, when you step out of your house, you have a lot of kids who are either into R&B and hip hop. If anyone saw the Blues Brothers, there's a scene when they walk into this country western bar and the band asks, what kind of music you play here? And they go, we play both kinds. We play country and western. That's kind of the same thing with like hip hop. Growing up with hip hop, it was like either hip hop or R&B. I didn't identify with that. I didn't identify with the fashions. I didn't identify with the music as a whole. Even though I did work for Pete Rock and Molly Mall back in the day, I was still a rock guy. My only advantage that I had is that I knew how to play bass, guitar, and drums, where I can take the samples and play them and literally save the money I'm paying for the cost. That was one thing that I had as an advantage for that. And I didn't like, yeah, I just didn't like being pigeonholed into the stereotype of like, you know, like back then, you were a white boy who listened to rock. But for me, I'm like, I didn't care. Like, that didn't bother me. But that kind of is what brought me into where Nicole and the Ann Hatches of the world and the Tony Berkeley's of the world, because that for me is where it all makes sense. I feel at home in that environment where we're a bunch of musicians who grew up in a variety of different situations, but we all had one thing in common. We all loved rock. You know, let me correct you, Randall. You said rock and roll. Rock and roll is the 50s. Today it's like, today you can say rock and yeah. You just fill in the gaps with everything that you want to work with. Well, but that's kind of where it's at for me, you know, growing up in that sense.
That's an interesting distinction, because usually I don't, you know, usually, well, I'll get into that later. We'll get back to Nicole. And all right, so your organization, the goal is to what?
The goal is to empower Black musicians, whether they're part of rock or not. If you rock, like if you're Bob Marley, like you rock, you know what I mean?
Right.
If you are like Living Color, you rock, you know, if you're Parliament, you rock, you know, there's a kind of a broader definition of what that is. And then there's the more specific term of, you know, guitarists, percussionists, et cetera, who are rock, metal, et cetera. And we want to make sure that they have a platform and somewhere to connect with other musicians like them and, you know, potential bandmates, et cetera.
And how do you do that?
Oh, digitally, we have a website, blackrockersunited.com, and we have like the timelines of blues, metal, punk, rock. So that educates people, like that's the first step on what the histories of these music genres are. And then we have the group on Facebook, Black Rockers United, in which you can actually interact with other musicians and join the group. Yeah.
Okay. But so you've got a whole music community, whole musical community kind of that Absolutely. Comes together.
Absolutely.
Now, Ann, we've gotten this. So now we've covering. I'm gonna come back and I wanna explore all the different things that you have and how can people join your organization. But I'm gonna jump over to speak to Ann and Tony. So I know Ann Atcher from our Club Helsinki virtual open mic, which is on every Tuesday. And I want to say about 4 months ago, Nia, our music coordinator, brought to us this video, crazy cool video, and it had so many different blends of different styles. And it had rock, it had a native vibe, it was soulful, and it just like I hadn't seen it. And you know, we get. You know, between we played over 800 artists in the last year during the pandemic, and we featured them. I hadn't seen anything like this, so we loved it. We got in touch with you. I think we played a couple of videos, and I, you know, just before we came on the air, I was saying how you know you actually personify. I don't know what that is, but you personify the rock vibe. Talk to me a little bit about your career and how you developed and sort of mixed all of these and blended all the sort of your cultural influences into your music.
Oh, well, you're talking to me?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, you know, I'm growing up partly in North Carolina, partly in Harlem. My grandfather's Bumpy Johnson.
Okay.
So I grew up around a lot of the Cab Calloway and, you know, Louis Armstrong helped me when I was a kid. And we all had the Jackson 5 and Motown. And, like, you know, we also would get into the cars and they would put on that beautiful, like, that classical music you would hear when you were coming down, like, the Major Deegan back in the days when we had the classical stations. Mm-hmm. And so growing up was, like, beautiful. But when the 80s kind of hit, I think, you know, it was so ghetto and hip hop was so heavy, but at the same time I needed an escape, and like my cartoons and, you know, animals and wildlife. And so the music that I started listening to was music that like, you know, got me out of the ghetto in a way. So heavy metal, like Anthony say, and rock was something that was like, what? You know, they were speaking like about things that weren't directly involved in our neighborhoods.
Right.
And because we already knew like the lyric to the message, like forward and backwards. By the time it came out, every kid in the neighborhood knew the message. And I think that it was, you know, just really getting into like drums and going down to the village and like, you know, I'm sorry, but buying weed off HR when we were little kids, like 13 years old, that's 83. And, you know, we was all nervous and like, you know, seeing the Bad Brains and the Squats, and then you go to like CB's as a little kid and they let you in. And, you know, that culture was there back then. And even the eccentricities of being able to go to a liquor store when you're a kid and go get a little thing between you and your friends and going out watching your bands, it was exciting. And like, you know, it was risque, and then we did the things that, you know, that they tell you not to do, but it kind of made us want to seek it even more, and the wilder it was, the more we wanted to be a part of it. So that was really my upbringing. I remember seeing like my uncle, you know, Cab Calloway practicing back in like, I think it was like 1979, 1980 when I was a little kid, and seeing the band together and being like, ah, man, I can do that. Maybe yeah. I can't, but you know, I was just like, I can do that, you know?
Nice. So we
had everything growing up, everything.
But it sounds like to me that some of the danger and the sort of excitement of rock sort of drew you in.
Yeah. Well, you look at an adventure, right? When you head out, let's say if you're looking at back in the days, you had the Dungeons and Dragons, you got the Warriors going out, there's a wizard, there's somebody, everybody got their own superpower. That was kind of like your little crew growing out, like your friends, everybody had a little bit of something different. One guy was super funny. The other guy was just, you know, always serious or whatever, but he got you out of trouble. So like, you know, it, growing up in that, looking at the characters and watching that in the music, so you would see the bands and you could see the characters of the people, so it was just the characters that got me. So growing up, I wanted to be like a Music Ali, somebody that came out, and although I might have funny videos, I had serious things that I said in the lyrics, you know, and I never talked about stupid, I don't use the word, you know, like the negative stuff, and, you know, I just stay positive, but I knock down, you know, I try to tell the truth and let creators speak through me. So growing up in Harlem was one thing. Growing up in the South was like, I heard a lot of native music. And back then, there were also even African musicians coming through the South and heading up north back in those days, you know? So you see the djembe and the drummers and everybody coming together, and you had rainbow gatherings and, you know, a lot of things that black culture didn't know. Because, you know, when you grow up in the city, you know, and if you've never known anything else, you know, it's kind of, there was almost a kind of like a frightening part of going into that world of the heavy metal or the rock music or the country music, because it has to be racist. It has to be satanic. Jazz music got the same thing when it got grown up, when people were saying from the Bible Belt doing blues, and when they were having the speakeasies and everything in those times, they would say that was sinful. But, you know, I don't believe in that, you know, and that for me was like, I'm going to step into the play. Okay, you say the devil's over there, let me go see.
Can I add on to what you just said just now, Ant?
Yeah.
Because growing up, I would always hear, I didn't hear any of that stuff until I left my house. Like, in my house, my mother never used the word satanic. I would play Alice in Chains. She would say, sounds a little weird, but she never said satanic. And when someone would complain about it, she would say, they would say, oh, your son's listening to heavy metal. My mother's like, my sons are not killing anybody, so you mind your business. Now, if a parent had a kid in jail, my mother would lift him a new way. Can we curse, Randall? We can't curse.
No, we cannot curse it.
All right, so no cursing. My parents, if they were talking about us listening to satanic music, my mother would say, well, guess what? Your son's in jail for murder. So obviously, my sons, that music isn't influencing my kids because they're out of jail. They don't smoke. They don't do drugs. You're telling me that what they're doing is bad? Look at your own family. Mind your business. Mind your business, she would say.
Okay, so on that note, we're gonna go to Tony. Now, Tony, what drew you? Now, Tony is an excellent guitar player, excellent singer. You know, we've played a lot together, and you know, I met Tony in the Club Helsinki. Used to be, and I believe it will be
actually
again
before Helsinki, Randall.
That's right. That is true too.
One of Jack JWK.
That's right, Jack Kelly's. Yep. Yes, right. But yeah, I mean, but there, you know, I see just a little sliver of what you do. But when we did the Blues Pro Jams at Club Helsinki, it's a bigger right. thing, and we got a chance to really meet and, you know, play in that venue a bunch of times. And you're an excellent guitar player, excellent singer. What brought you to Rocks? And, you're from the Albany area. So we've got Ann Hatcher is from I think right now he's down in Miami. But from New York, we've connected with him in the UK, and let me just get the geolocation of everyone. So Anthony's in Westchester, you're in Albany, in the greater Albany metropolitan area. And Nicole, where are you out of?
I'm right outside of DC.
Right out of DC. My son's in DC.
Ooh, it's cold up there.
Okay.
Yeah, it is, man. It really is.
It's cold everywhere up here, man.
Colder than Miami.
Yeah. Colder than Miami.
Man, y'all stuff. I feel sorry for black people in cold weather. Aren't we from Africa or something like that?
Allegedly, we are. Allegedly, we are.
Now, Ricardo's on the line. I'm going to ask you to unmute.
Hold on.
There you go. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
How you doing, man?
Blessed. I'm very blessed. And how are you?
We are well, and thank you for being with us today. And again, you're listening
likewise.
To WGXC 90.7, and we are having a great conversation with a bunch of regional musicians and musical influencers. And today's topic is the diversity of music that is out there in the black community. And it's weird because we're talking about this almost in a backward fashion, because, you know, rock and roll or rock, you know, when you go back to Bo Diddley, when you go back to, you know, the real roots of rock and roll, you know, Little Richard and exactly. You know, that was a black music art form.
And Ike Turner.
That's right.
Ike Turner.
Little Richard. you know what's great about Little Richard? Like, you know, it's funny because I'm a big Motorhead fan. I ride a motorcycle. When I get on the road, man, I put my Motorhead on sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, he is a total Little Richard fan, the guy from Motorhead, the metal band.
Lemmy. Mm-hmm. Lemmy's a fan of, yeah. Big fan of Little Richard.
Big time.
Yep.
And so, perfect. So, Ricardo, tell us a little bit about you. You're the only one on the call yet. We haven't really introduced yet. So give us a little background on you, sir.
Ricardo, can you hear?
Could I hear me?
Yeah. Tell the audience.
Ricardo manages a band. I'll give you a little bit of a brief. I met Ricardo through a band called the Oxygen Box Band. What I love about them is that they're a diverse group. They're Caribbean. They do a mix of rock and reggae, also with a Haitian influence. And Ricardo manages them. I interviewed them for New York Caribbean a couple of years ago.
Okay.
And that's how we became very cool with each other.
Okay. And where is Ricardo joining us from?
I'm from Montclair, New Jersey.
Okay. All right. So we got Jersey in the house. Okay. So I'm gonna jump back to Tony. You play a lot of Hendrix, and you're very good at it. I mean, you're a great guitar player. You've mastered those strokes. And you play a variety of different music, but in terms of rock, what got you really stimulated to explore that music and make it your own?
Well, generally, what it came down to a lot. I just grew up listening to everything. I liked it. I just liked it. And a lot of it tended to be, was a lot of rock and roll. I mean, the pop stuff, AM radio was playing, really was the biggest influence in everything of my rock and roll, you know, upbringing. There was a time all you heard was just the Beatles, the British Invasion, which was pretty much all the blues from way back in the day, you know, that was just interpreted by all those British musicians back in those days and everything too. And so you had a lot of, that's where a lot of the rock came from, and it was built from, you know, all those old blues players and everything. and just listen to, you know, for me, just listen to AM radio. I mean, all the time. I always had chores to do. I always had to work. Always had to, you know, earn my keep, because I was, you know, raised up with my grandparents, and they came through the Depression, and when you was black and you was coming through the Depression back then, I mean, you always showed the pictures of all the hard times that, you know, everybody else was having, but
right.
When black people went through the Depression, they went through the Depression. It was,
right,
I mean,
right.
But it wasn't known for
Ken Burns to really go through that in total depth and detail. That's a whole, you know, whole series in itself right there.
That's right.
But listening to the radio, you know, all the time. I mean, the Beatles and all the different things that popped up. The one hit wonders, you know, Eddie Grant, you know, when he played with, I forget the band he used to play with back in the day, Comeback, and a lot of the rock and roll group and things there, the Troggs, Wild Thing, and, you know, I mean, you start hearing that guitar, it just attracted me. I just love hearing that. But at the same time, I was listening to Motown. And I'm
like, hold on. Who's that?
I was listening to everything at that time. But I mean, but rock and roll basically is just a whole total amalgamation of everything that, you know, that's ever been played, you know, and really rooted in the blues.
So, true, true. It's all rooted in the blues, if you think about it.
Yeah.
It's all, see, the blues are church. If you think about the influences in that way, and everything. Oh, yeah. It all comes full cycle in many ways. I'm not saying Bill Haley and the Comets think to come back, because they're not going to. 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock, rock. No, we're not going to have that come back.
No. You know? I don't know why not, though.
Oh, no. I'm going to give you a little. Does anyone know here? Does anyone here know what the term cover comes from? Cover song. You know where it comes from?
Well, we've talked about it, but I want you to expound on it.
Does anyone here know what it means? Cover song was started. It's a racist term. When Motown became popular, or the black artists became popular, if you notice, they would literally put out a band, like, for example, Little Richard's Tutti Frutti. Pat Boone had a version of it that was, of course, it was bamboo. So you had to make a version that was palatable for white people. So you would cover it as it started climbing the charts. So you would cover the song to put it down. So that back then, before it became rock and roll, it was known as race music. And then they needed cover terms, cover songs, to literally pop anything that a black artist did that started crossing over into the mainstream charts. Because back then, remember, R&B wasn't, you didn't have the Billboard 100 R&B and all that separate stuff. You just had the pop charts. Once it crossed over to the charts.
So that, that mean that.
Go ahead, Ann.
But doesn't mean that back in the days, those brothers were undercover?
No.
Well, you know what? Could I say something? You know, I want to say that, you know, I agree with everything everyone is speaking about. And the thing about it is that even today, it's a cover, you know. So, you know, listen, the game is not new. You know, they started the game. They processed it. And the thing about it is that nothing is going to be advantageous to us, you know. So we always get the short end of the stick. You know, I'm saying, look, we're talking about Little Richard. Man, you know, you should have been a billionaire, you know, but, you know, and rules and regulations, bylaws, you know, that they instituted in place to cover up for the cover.
True.
Right. And basically the exploitation of either our music and boxing us in or out of a particular genre when the money was being made. But now. But now, in the last year, we've had an unprecedented thing happen. You know, music has basically stopped, paused. What do you guys think? And many of us kind of predict that there will be sort of a revival. You know, music will be sort of people are all this pent up demand for music and new musical styles. What do you guys see on the horizon? I'll start with Nicole first, and then we'll work our way through.
Thank you, Randall. What I see is like an amazing, like you said, revival of music, both live and virtual, and then like a mix of those two, I guess, like a hybrid. And in terms of like the East Coast, like the Mid-Atlantic scene, like DC, Delaware, Virginia, etc., I do like a calendar like per week for like live events. It's massive. Like there's people performing like all over the place that I didn't even think were performing anymore. Like Chicago is playing live this summer.
Really?
You know what I mean? Like, yeah, like Seven Dust is playing live this summer. Like all these people have basically had time to hone their skills. So my answer is like, yeah, that time has given people kind of this new fire for music. And I'm really proud of that. I'm sorry that it happened that way, but it seems like it gave people time to recharge and kind of get back into the groove.
Yes. I agree. And I think honestly, I think that it had to happen like this. It's unfortunate in a lot of ways. I also think a big contributing factor to it is the Black Lives Matter. So in a lot of ways you have, I don't want to call it white guilt, but I guess there's guilt amongst corporations who now feel the need to fund more Black-based businesses, fund more Black entertainers, form more Black production companies, more Black filmmakers, more Black directors. So as far as entertainment goes, I think there'll be kind of almost like a resurgence of Black artists across the board. Now, as far as it generating sales, that's really up to us. Because I always hear people say, we don't sell enough, but we have to support each other first. This is another thing that we do too much. I used to work with Toni Morrison. We did an Obama fundraiser together in 2007. She was on our committee. And the one thing she would always say is she didn't write her books to get validated by white people. She would say, if you really want to truly free yourself, stop writing or doing anything and getting to get acceptance from white people. You will truly free yourself. And just the way she said that like at 2 a.m. one time, sipping whiskey and smoking a cigarette. She's like,
acknowledgement.
Yeah, she's like, you need to think in terms of, she doesn't write to get the validation of white people. And I've learned that just from being around her. So she would talk about a process. She goes, no, I don't care if they like my books or not. I'm not trying to write to them. So therefore, I'm freer in my process. If you're writing to appeal to that market, she's like, you're only going to fail because you're not writing from your heart. You're doing it to get the crossover material or whatever. You're doing it for the money, per se.
Right, but you should do it and be pure about your craft.
Yes.
Now, Toni, you are you play all over the place. You're a frequent, local club musician. You play in a lot of different venues. What are you thinking about and looking forward to on the local scene? Because you're usually playing out locally 2-3 times a week, in the Capital District. So what do you see, Toni?
Well, I'm seeing that everybody's going to be changing, I mean, all this time to sit down and really rethink how things were. And I mean, even I was blessed to play, I would say some, to a degree. I mean, it wasn't to my satisfaction. I mean, it wasn't really like a really, I really love doing this. But there's something inside me said, this isn't the best of the situation, not only for me, but many other musicians there too. And you gave me plenty of time to really start thinking that, we need to step out and step up and be a whole lot better as far as business-wise, as far as choosing. And I could go back to what Anthony was talking about of, not just, just playing, well, the first thing they usually ask you, say, well, what's the song list? What songs do you play and everything? And you pretty much got to customize your song list and everything to be able to go into their clubs and everything to play. But I got to the point where I'm not even thinking about that anymore. I just say, I'm going to just play what's going on as had men and women that are much wiser than me. They say, well, it's fine what you're playing, covering this, covering that. But we want to hear what's going on in here. We want to hear what's going on in you. And so that's pretty much what I'm going forward to, play what's going on inside of me. If it comes out as rock and roll or alternative or just, whatever, that's just the way it's going to just come out. And I think that there's nothing more rock than that, than just being able to just play what's going on inside of you.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been doing a whole lot of writing this in this whole year, and things are formed up and they're shaping up really well. I presented them to a couple of radio stations, and they're listening, they're really eating it up and everything. And you know, and I guess the funny thing, everybody's looking for a reference point. You know, well, you sound like this, you sound like that. I said, well, I don't know. I pretty much try to sound like me. This is what's going on with me. And sometimes it's what I might have heard in the past. I mean, you might hear, be able to identify some of the influences, but they often say that, you know, you've got a unique kind of thing that's going on and everything. And that's more rewarding to me than anything else anybody can, you know, ask me to do. So
I'm going to piggyback off of what you said. Has anyone here ever played in Europe? And obviously you played in Europe. Tony, have you ever played in Europe? Okay, think about it like this. Jimi Hendrix had to leave America and go all the way over to England.
Oh, brother.
To become popular.
Brother, you.
Become popular.
Brother.
Because we live in a culture that wants to compartmentalize everything. You got to put you in the box.
Brother, can I tell you something?
Sure, go ahead,
man. Can I tell you something, Anthony? Listen, when I lived in England, it's just funny to understand, because I was thinking about this before. I was going to throw it out. It's funny how you tapped into that. I think that if Jimi Hendrix was to come there nowadays, they'd have blanked him out and got somebody who can do 10 times less than he can and push them more than they would Jimmy.
Yeah.
That's how things have changed in England.
Yep.
And you have
true. People
like Sonafly, who are a really underground group, because we were saying about the COVID, it's about the grassroots right now.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, the Grateful Dead came through and they did their thing, and like P-Funk has that type of following, and Phish and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
But when you're in England, they really don't want to give love to black artists and musicians. The rest of Europe will, however.
Germany
is
huge. Germany will. France will. Sweden. Yeah, they will hook you up in that way. Even if you play as a local artist, I remember playing in Germany. I was in Cologne, and back then I had dreads. And I remember this young kid was following me, like literally, kid's like 16 years old. He followed me to 4 shows. One day he approached me, and he had a whole thing written out for me. He was like, "Okay, man, because I'm gonna call you Squid." And goes, and then when you dance on stage with your bass, you're getting squidistic. And then when you have your followers, they're doing squidism. He literally, this kid who I didn't even know, made this whole thing for me. And then I had a baby hat that my ex-girlfriend was Filipino. She's kind of a big head. So I remember asking, can I borrow her hat for a gig one day? And then in Germany, I wore it in Germany. And everyone approached me and said, hey, man, I want to buy your hat. I found that they really want a piece of you when you go there, and they like what you do. Here, it's not so much like that. Europe, it's so much like if they love what you do, they will want a piece of you. So I got, like, at the time, it was before they went into, it was Deutschmarks. Someone offered me $100, 100 DMs just for my little baby hat. That was like a little navy hat that I wore. Crazy stuff, man.
Very,
soak
very
it up.
Cool. So, Tony, you're saying, not Tony, Ant, you're saying that, in your experience, what are you looking forward to? What do you think this year is going to bring? And then expound upon your experience over there in England versus the United States versus the rest of Europe.
Well, for me, when the COVID hit, I mean, this microphone is a karaoke mic. I used to walk up and down the beaches here in Florida, and I would get people to sing songs on the beach. Mm-hmm. And the other part, I lived on an Indian reservation in Big Cypress. So I was up with, and then I also was on a chicken farm with friends that had a recording studio in a place called Loxahatchee, which means Turtle River in Seminole language. So for me, it was like, when COVID hit, it was my cue to get back to the roots. Because when I go to the festivals nowadays, if there's a drum circle, everybody gets moved in their heart. So I've been always able to do the concerts on stage singing, and I've been able to do the drum circles because that's on my heart as well, playing the African drumming and with the real drummers and the, you know what I mean, like the proper drummers, and getting everybody come together. That meant a lot to me. So in England, when I do the African Indians, I had up to 15 people in my band sometimes, because every time we came, I was so free form about the band. And we got to a certain level where we were playing the Queen Elizabeth Hall, and I was singing lyrics like, don't believe all that corporate shit, they'll just lie, they'll hang a martyr from a crucifix to get, but you know, and I was doing that in Queen Elizabeth Hall in front of all these people, and I noticed that there was an underground. The thing that always supported any music scene that I've ever seen, especially in the old school New York, was the squatting system. Because you got all these empty buildings and people still homeless and people, musicians and artists paying money and can't even get together because they're not even living near each other. Where the squat system put people together. That's why you had the Bad Brains. Mm-hmm. That's why you had people downtown and even our brothers and sisters. The Commodores used to live in the same rooms together. You know what I mean? It goes back so far. So my experience was the underground absorbed me and the mainstream came to me because they were supposed to be the big guys, the Robert Plants, the Adam Ants, but they all wanted to come and like hang out with us because we were having fun, you know? But the big guys, it was difficult. The big guys, it was difficult, to be honest.
And what do you see coming forward in this year, like the resurgence of music? Where do you see the gains?
I think people are tired. I think people are tired, and you better amaze them. I think if you're going to come out, I'm tired. I think people are like a full cup. I mean, even the young kids are more full than we were, because, I mean, and we had crack on the streets and all that other crazy stuff and people dying around us, you know, but at the same time, it was like the Wild Wild West. So I think the idea is like, you know, kind of like break the norm. Whatever you got to do to break the norm. Okay. I mean, it doesn't, music, you can throw everybody a billion songs. It's like if you're the best drummer in the world, if you're not playing with anybody, you're just sitting up there being the best drummer in the world. It's still a lonely thing to be.
Right.
And making your music on a computer is not the same as sitting down and spending time with your friends and going out and falling off shit and, like, you know, having a good time and meeting girls and getting smacked, whatever, you know what I'm saying, or boys, whatever.
No smack. Just meeting girls.
Nah, it's all right, man. If you like it, you like it. You know, it ain't gonna be all PG now. Come on, Anthony. I don't like a little bad, little smack on the butt every now and then.
Oh, that kind of smack. I thought you meant like, yeah. Oh, I thought you meant like drugs, because I don't.
I want to say that. What I want to see is that.
I'm your private.
What I want to see.
And that's another artist that had to go to Europe.
Clearly, I'm going to have to edit this show.
Good. Nicole, go ahead. No, wait, I want to hear Nicole's perspective. Yeah. Nicole's.
Hold on.
I want to apologize for any misogyny that was unintended to happen tonight. So I'm going to say,
I think he was saying that, you know, when you're touring and you go out and you meet people and, you know, you might say something inappropriate and then, you know, a young lady might have to remind you of your manners. And so I'm assuming that's what you were talking about, that you might have to be reminded of levels of appropriateness that you might lose throughout the course of an evening.
I thought we were musicians. Isn't that part of the job? I was
See, now we were talking about Anthony.
That girl right there is so smart. You see her right there? She's past it. She's looking at us like, you know, like she's Spock and we like McCoys.
Ant is living a rock and roll life. We talked about it. Ant is the personification of rock and roll.
Yes.
But before we get back to Nicole, though, Ricardo, you were saying something. You got cut off. Go ahead.
Yeah, I did notice, Ricardo. What were we going to say?
You know, everything is going back. Everything is going back to some times that were overlapped in the 60s, 70s, 80s. And I feel that that's part of the new norm, which is an acceptance of the new music, old music that they never played or really gave life to, and so it's a new world. It's a new age and people doing things. There was a time that, you know, you didn't listen to certain music on certain stations. I think the new norm will allow for it to transition, you know. Mm-hmm. And allowing people to listen to what they want to hear. And basically what you guys were talking about earlier about rock, you know, rock has always been here. And so it's always been supposed quote unquote white dominated, you know, but black folks have, that is our music, you know, that's all our music. And so at the end of the day, it goes back to us being able to be free to show our art. And that's been the problem. We have been prohibited to excel at what we do.
Now, what do you, thank you, well said. Now your band, you're a manager of a band. How do you feel? Are we going to go back to where live music is going to be sort of king in terms of making making money? I mean, the record industry has changed. There's a lot of different dynamics at play. How are musicians going to be able to sustain themselves? Is it going to be merch and live music? Is it going to be the recording model where people self-publish and they bypass, you know, the big major brands? I'm going to ask you, Ricardo, first. Then I'll go to Ant, and then we'll come back to Tony, and then ask Nicole.
Well, as I see it, this is going to have to be a collaborative effort by musicians and bands. There has to be a cohesiveness about it, and what I'm talking about is the reality of everything that transpires, pay, everything that comes with that, you know. So I feel that it's going to be interesting because, again, you know, as you mentioned earlier, in certain parts of the country, they already have plateaus of events already taking place. Like, for example, my family is in Palm Beach. You know, it's a different world compared to here.
Right.
You know, so they've been at the beach and playing volleyball and cooking. And so, you know, this whole situation, it comes to the reality that it's that each state is actually a different country.
Okay. All right.
You know, it's a different country. Basically, I'm saying, you know, in Miami Beach, they still have, they're having curfews. You know, my sister's not down anymore. There.
Did you say not anymore, Ant?
Not really. That was because of the spring break that was down here, but that's all finished.
Okay.
Yeah, but Miami, it is what it is. Washington Avenue, Collins Avenue, all that is happening, you know. And so you have a lot, and you should be right, a lot of tourists have left, and some people that have come as tourists have decided to stay. A lot of people stay.
Now, aren't there going to be less clubs? I mean, I know that many clubs have taken a hit throughout this, so there might actually be even less venues. And so the clubs that
couldn't afford to stay open, they're the ones that are going to come back.
Right, exactly.
But there's also a new level of through the Biden administration and all these SBA loans, they have a thing called a restaurant club restoration program, where they're literally giving people money to build entertainment venues.
Interesting.
So it's not so much making it up. They're trying to literally get it so that it does. It gets like nothing worse than being able to run outside your house and there's no place to go. You know, now they're trying to reinvigorate the system. So those who are going to make it, at least they'll have the opportunity to get, I forgot the total amount of money. It's anywhere from like $100,000 to like $1 million to get yourself back in order. But if you don't sign on by May 31st, you won't get the opportunity to make the money.
People need to look into this if you're interested. Yes. Are you saying this is for existing club owners or for anyone looking for a venue?
You have to have past experience, obviously. They're not going to just give you money.
It's almost like PEP money. That's what it is.
It's exactly what it is. Okay. It doesn't matter, man. Money is money. If you can apply for
it. Definitely. I agree.
Hop on that, then make it happen. So that at least gives people an opportunity to start having these venues, where you start building your venues. They're also encouraging, some places are giving cabaret licenses. Even if you have an apartment,
and you can seat so many people, they're trying to encourage more of that. There's plenty of ways of being able to get around
Nicole's interest. Nicole,
back to the roots.
But I'm just saying that it's they're trying to find a way to get people back to where it is, because the idea of keeping it that this fear-based thing that America, that we're going to crawl under a rock because a disease came along and put us under, makes people a little nervous. So, of course, the government's like, look, get everyone back into play. So if you can create all these programs, it now creates an opportunity for you to make an income and generate revenue. You know, and that's just not, that's not, that's only part of it. Now, is anyone here familiar with the 360 deal? So you know what a 360 deal is, okay. Because we don't have vinyl. Remember back in the day, you had vinyl, CDs, cassettes. You had what they call mechanicals. You sold mechanicals.
Yeah.
So let's say that you had a deal. I'll use Hootie and the Blowfish as an example because they made a lot of money. So when you had a deal with a record label, you were basing it upon two things, your publishings and your mechanical sales. So back in the old days, they would sell CDs, vinyl, tapes, cassettes, and if you were way back, 8-track tapes.
Merch.
So, and yeah, but now merch is now. Merch wasn't part of the deal. Merch wasn't part of the deal until later.
That was our stuff.
Yeah, merch started up, and though he started the whole merch thing, George Lucas in Star Wars.
Was that's
the one,
right.
He was the one behind Star Wars merch.
Master Yoda.
Yep, so now when you have the whole, you have the back then you had, so let's say an album costs $10. You had a deal for, your deal was you got a dollar per album. By the time that they were done pulling out all the expenses and shipping everything else, you ended up making 25 cents per album. So you really weren't making any money. Now, Hootie and the Blowfish, they ended up making $4 per CD because they were making so much money by themselves as a group back in the whole, I think they're like South Carolina based back then, in that whole South Carolina area. So yeah. when I think it was Atlantic Records approached them, they said, well, we don't really need you guys. And then, what do you mean? We make a lot more money. We did the math. If we sell 1 million records, we can sell 50,000 records and make the same amount of money. So why do we need to work with you guys? And that's when they gave them that phenomenal deal of like $4 per CD, which is a lot of money, considering that they sold like a zillion records.
NWA as well.
Well, they had their own. They had their own Priority Records was their record label. They made. They literally. It wasn't them signing on. They signed on to a distribution deal. They owned the record label, therefore they made the money. So if you own the think about it like this. I'll use drugs as an example. If you're the distributor, and then you're filtering down all that stuff to everybody else, and you're flying your cocaine to Florida and getting all the drug deals, the distributor makes all the money. The distributor makes the mass amount of the money. And the artist gets paid the least, unless you're an artist who creates a record label, owns your own publishing company, and then you sign on to, you sign a distribution deal. You're not signing a record, you're not signing a record label deal. You're signing a distribution deal. Fast forward to where we are right now.
Money.
Those mechanicals are all gone. Now you have merchandise, as Ant said earlier, you have merchandise. So you're basically making your money off of merchandise. And now if you're an unsigned artist, and for you to generate some serious revenue, you gotta have a decent sized fan base. Or is it, how would you say, Nicole? You know more about that than I do.
Fan base, following squad, everyone calls it something different.
Yep. Yeah. If you're who is it, the Queen Bee Army? Beyonce?
Her bees.
She got the bees.
Her little bees.
They'll come after you if you make fun of them too.
Right, that's why.
If you get a loyal following to help generate your revenue and support you, then it's like, then you're going to do fine. But that's probably one of the key things. Otherwise, to me, all the bands that are coming out now, I find the older generation is a little tougher to deal with, but the newer bands, this is their technology, so they'll do fine. It's the older guys who will have a problem struggling with it, because they'll go right back into the old school, play the bar, you'll have 5 people in it, if you're lucky, maybe 10 if you include the staff, you know, the watch, and they'll keep that whole cycle going.
Well, now, then perfect.
But I think there's nothing new under the sun.
True, it's recycling these things, but
it's recycling the old things. You're right, yeah,
but it is different now. And you play. Are you a signed or unsigned artist? Do you have your own label? I know that you also work with a collective of musicians yourself.
Yeah, I was signed with Hempstead Digital Records, which is Ari Sur, with the guys that sing like "Back Is Black." You know those guys?
band. You're listening to WGXC 90.7.
But that was more like a friendship deal, so just so I can get the numbers, because I was quite, you know.
Like that.
Yeah. And then I had a publisher, and they were both pretty useless. Everything that I've ever done was basically off the back that I was able to, like, have people that like me.
Yes.
You're an entertainer.
Yes.
Yeah. You're an artist, but you're also an entertainer.
Way. That really goes a long way.
That's the network.
Yeah. It does. That is the network.
I just like to have a good time.
Nicole, what are fans going to be looking for this summer, you think?
I think everyone's right. I think Ann's definitely right in the sense that because there's nothing new under the sun, like, you better come with some real, like, innovative stuff that people have not heard. It should be a blend, a hybrid of styles.
I'm noticing that it's a lot more extreme. Totally got to be all that.
I'm noticing that people are going for a lot of the, like, more extreme styles of anything, like, be it, like, hip-hop or metal, which, like, causes
and reggae music.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is very soulful, very like tribal indigenous music. I think that people are absolutely going to be listening to more indigenous music. I've noticed that.
Usually I wait till the end, but I want to make sure that we have enough time to get this in. So I want everybody to talk about how our all listening audience can reach and know more about your group and organization. Then we'll cover one last topic before we go to hour two. So we're going to start with you, Nicole, since you were already you were just speaking. How can people find out more about your organization, what you're doing, and become a member?
Absolutely, Randall. We have a group on Facebook, Black Rockers United, spelled like it sounds. And then we have a website, blackrockersunited.com. You can find an entire community of Black people just like yourself who are into music, namely rock, but also other genres too, you know? Check it out. Find us on YouTube, Instagram, etc. We would love to meet you. And yeah, thanks for rocking with us.
Very nice. Tony, how can people find out more about where you play, your originals, you know, where to get your CDs and our records? Give people the lowdown.
Well, I currently have a couple different places. You guys see me on Facebook, Berkstar. Is you just go to Berkstar on Facebook, Facebook.com/Berkstar, and you'll be able to, you know, pull me up. I usually post things on there. Plus, I have a YouTube channel. Just go to Berkstar One, and you'll be able to see some videos of, you know, might even see you, Randall, on there.
This is true. This is true.
Right there. Also, I have a website, a couple websites that you guys should go to. I mean, a lot of people don't use Reverb that much, but I've got to take content on there, www.reverbnation.com/Berkstar. And also, you could go to, I actually have a website too, www.berkstar.com.
Nice.
And I'm currently uploading and updating a lot of new things on there, you know, I guess pretty much the fruits of my labor within the last year.
Very nice. Thank you. And Hatcher, when you're not on your motorcycle, how can people find you?
How can you get a ride on your motorcycle?
You can ride your bike for free.
I'm putting that on the back of my motorcycle. Maybe my big brother. That's about it. We're all brothers now. Okay. But, all right, to find me. All right, I'm on, if you just put my name, Ann Hatcher, and then put the OAI. The OAI stands for the Original African Indians, which is a band that I've had for 20-some-odd years. And we also got OAI.rocks, and that's still up, and that's running, and I'm still putting stuff out. I just worked with the track with Patrick Anthony from UB40 called Lucrative, and they're releasing it out in England right now. And also, I'm giving a talk next week, which is really interesting, here in Miami at the Hampton House, where Muhammad Ali used to stay, and Sam Cooke was at the Black House, where all the brothers and James Brown was staying. And I'm going to be talking about the relationship between my grandfather Bumpy and Malcolm X, and what's going on with this Harlem Godfather. Godfather of Harlem film, that's really a horrible, horrible, don't back this family. Don't back this. I'm a Johnson. Let me tell you. Don't back this. Don't back this TV series. Okay. Forrest Whitaker's not a very nice guy. Okay. So and that's where y'all find me on the music. I'm just saying that because, you know, when you're a nice guy, those are the ones that you don't treat bad, because a nice guy don't deserve that. God don't like that.
Okay.
So, you know, within music, you can find me up on there, and, you know, I'm going to be looking for everybody else as well. I already got my pen over here writing everybody's information down.
Very well. Very well said, Ricardo. Your group, yeah. Give us the name of your group and how we can find them.
OxygenBoxBand.com on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, on all platforms.
On all social media platforms.
I'm sorry?
On all social media platforms.
Right, right. Exactly, exactly.
All right, Randall, I'm going to plug myself before you go, Randall.
No, I was coming to you. You're not.
Okay, just making sure. Anthony.Gethers at Instagram.
Yep.
AnthonyGethers.com for my t-shirts. I have a customized Bass Lee shirt, which is Bruce Lee. Bruce Lee playing bass. So I have that.
I saw that.
Yep. So I have my customized shirts. And then on my IMDb, because I'm still a video director, even though I'm an underemployed video director, on IMDb.com, just search Anthony Gethers. Gethers with my feathers with a G, G-E-A-T-H-E-R-S. Yeah, and you'll see all my movie stuff, movie, TV, and film stuff there.
Well, thank you guys. This has been wonderful. You know, so Nicole, so if as we do our events, can we post information on your site, or if people need or want to know where the what's happening, black rock music, especially music is happening, can they go to Black Rockers United and find those shows and those itineraries on your site?
If they want to know like more about current shows, I have my own like site, NicoleKhalid.com,
okay,
with like mid-Atlantic like metal punk rock shows. And then connected to that, you can find BlackRockersUnited.com.
Gotcha. And spell
so
it
kind of like
Nicole, what was your last name?
N-I-C-O and then Kali. So N-I-C-O-K-A-L-I.
Well, once again, thank you, and we're back on the Tuesday afternoon radio show on WGXC 90.7. And, you know, following our musical interview with all of our great guests, we have a Hudsonian here and a very dynamic young lady. I've known her for a little bit over a year, and she's tremendously involved in the community. She's very gifted and really has taken her mission to helping especially the black community here in Hudson get together, gather, know their legacy, their history, and put on and produce events that really help to reinforce the model of community and communicating intergenerationally. And I can't say enough about this young lady and what she's doing here in Hudson. Tanya Jackson, are you there?
Yes, 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 I am here. Thank you for the introduction, Randall. It was wonderful to be with you.
Well, it is. It's wonderful the work that you are doing. Why don't you get more specific and let some of the people know about you and sort of the things that you're doing and the things that you are currently actually preparing to do.
Yes, thank you for that. And thank you for calling me a young lady. I like you even more now. So, yeah, I am a Hudsonian, as you say, not generationally, but have been a child of Hudson since about the fifth grade or so. I think just going into the sixth grade when my family migrated up here from the city. and went to middle school, high school here, undergrad at SUNY Albany, and then went on to discover my own adult journey in the city, and then in Philly for about 11 years, and then moved back to New York in 2012, but to the city, and then came back to Hudson area. It's going on 3 years now. Yeah, I came back in 2019. And so through that journey and through, coming of age in terms of my adulthood, harnessed a bunch of skills, learned a bunch of things of the world and of myself. And as you highlighted, some of the things that I've acquired under my belt have to do with the media arts, educating in the media arts, as well as doing program management. I've worked for film festivals. I've worked for various nonprofits. I've worked, for in the corporate sector for a stint, and worked with young people specifically throughout, and have found my journey has led me and has always kept me deeply in touch with the communities that I live in and have always been invested in. And so moving back to Hudson, I knew that when I moved back here, I came back because my mom had, had surgery. She's getting older now, and I came back to help her out in a personal sense. But I also knew that I wanted to bring all of my full self and what, I've learned through college. I went and got my master's degree while I was in Philly, also in media studies. And I wanted to bring my vast hats and roles back to Hudson, and I wanted to say thank you and give back. I came up under Miss Bunny, Lynn Carr, and so I
two icons of the Hudson scene.
Yes. One of the Hudson families, one of the Black Hudson families generationally. And that experience as a kid, she modeled community engagement. She modeled and stressed vehemently what it meant for us to love on ourselves and build up ourselves. And she poured into me deeply. She wasn't the only one, but she was a major factor along with my mother and some other mentors who made me aware of what it meant to stand in the gap around celebrating and uplifting ourselves. And so I've always carried that torch in me, and so when I moved back here, I knew that I wanted to bring that full circle for not for myself only, but also for my family and my community. And so since I've been back here, my cousin and I, actually, initially, she came to me, and she's another Hissonian who, moved here as a child, and they, have, Ngonda Badilla, a lot of people know the Badillas, and, know of the various productions and things that they've done in Hudson. And so she and I got together, and she came to me, it's like, I want to do something. This was last year during, the height of the pandemic, and the fervor and the summer of, the Freedom Summer, as it's being called, around the George Floyd murder and the uprisings. And this was, things were starting to, get underway in a national sense, and we were already bubbling about doing something locally. And when Juneteenth was coming around, she came to me. She said, I couldn't think of a better person to share this idea with, and it was about doing something for Juneteenth. And so I said, yeah, I've actually been in the lab of myself of figuring out giving back and thinking about Juneteenth as well. And so the energy aligned, and we fell into planning and then figuring out how to make that happen. And so and that's how you and I met.
Yes.
Through our desire was to begin by seeking our elders. And we knew that we wanted to develop a celebration that centered ourselves, that centered our joy, and centered us loving each other. And we knew that, you know, we wanted to bring cultural values to even the planning process. And so we reached out to you and reached out to a few other elders and community leaders and said, this is what we want to do. We, you know, one, it was kind of like, you know, do we have your support, your blessing, and will you lend your expertise to helping us make this happen? Because, you know, it was like something that was just like a 2-week turnaround, and it really showed us what was possible with, you know, connecting with other people as well as being determined to make something happen. And, you know, the mayor got behind us and made sure we got the permits and everything fell into place. And for, you know, putting together on an event on such short notice, I think we did a good job.
You guys did a wonderful job.
Yeah, thank you. And it was, you know, by and large, you know, so much of what, you know, our elders helped us to do, you know, you with the AV system and getting us, you know, what you were able to do for us in terms of the infrastructure of the day was like priceless, you know. And Elena Mosley and Operation Unite and AME Church allowing us to use the basement and the grill, and, you know, Robert on the grill, and just the way that the community came together, the way that we were able to put it on it in terms of financing it was just, we went to Facebook and we went to the community and said, hey, we want to do this thing, and we want to, you know, raise the money to give out free food and to have, you know, free activities and workshops for the young people and have music and just be joyful for the day, you know. And people showed up and showed out and donated, and we were able to put it on and then pay the people like yourself, like, you know, folks who were able to, like, who went above and beyond. And the community, you know, was for us, by us, you know, additional support from other folks who just like, you know, I'm not part of, you know, your cultural community, but I want to support you. And so it was really amazing. It really gave us, you know, that encouragement and that, you know, kind of assessing that we're hungry for this, we deserve this, and people are just, you know, wanting, you know, for us to do more of this. And so because of how well it went last year on such short notice, we knew that we wanted to keep it going, you know.
So for some
we knew we could.
Let me just jump in, and for the edification of some people who don't know what Juneteenth is and what it represents, can you elaborate?
Yeah, so Juneteenth initially was celebrated by, I guess, recently freed, as it were, enslaved Black people in Texas. So when the Emancipation Proclamation was signed, mm-hmm. the order went into effect a few months later. It goes out across, you know, the United States that, you know, enslaved people are no longer in bondage. They, you know, everyone has their freedom in, you know, in a physical sense. And word did not get to Texas. And so it wasn't until June 19th that the Texonian Black folks knew that they were free. And so they, you know, marked Juneteenth as the end of slavery for everyone who had been enslaved, the descendants of Africans who had been enslaved in the United States, because they were the last to be told of it and were the last to be freed completely. And so that right. was where Juneteenth originated, and it grew across the United States to a cultural holiday, you know, in some places, including Hudson, thanks to Mayor Kamal Johnson, that Juneteenth is a celebration of Black freedom from enslavement.
Yes. And what happened at that event was really, for me, remarkable, because we had a chance to have an interactive conversation to the community, with the community, and about, I think, very important and personal, pertinent issues, and personal, and also in terms of sharing our experiences, and really sort of taking on the sort of methodology that many peoples have used to sort of transmit information from generation to generation to say, this is how we got here. This is where we are, and this is how we got here. And it was wonderful, and it was just such a sense of community and engagement that I'm very happy that you're doing it again. And what are your thoughts for this year, coming out of COVID, coming out of the year that we had last year, that really brought to it really exposed the ongoing tension and disparity of justice that people of color face in this nation, with many armed with many police departments around the country. What do you see, and what are your thoughts for this year, and what you want to do and focus on?
Yeah, thank you for that question. So coming out of all the things, one thing that was that I'm centered in and will continue to be centered in around Juneteenth in Hudson is centering our joy. And for me, centering our joy is a healing, is healing, because we, our existence, our capacity to continue to be here in the ways that we show up to life, in the ways that we struggle, in the ways that we try, in the ways that we mess up, we get up, we fight back, we birth, we live, we love, we grow. Those things are, to me, is, part of our superpower. And I think that joy just has this capacity to keep us going, and it can be healing, and it allows us to, deconstruct and when I say heal, I mean there's a healing with our own identity, our own self-esteem, communally and individually. There are ways that our historical journey and our evolution in this country has been set up in a way to try to rob us mm-hmm. of our humanity, rob us of our dignity, rob us of all these things, that are innately desires of any human being and rights of any human being. And for me, as we keep struggling, as we keep striving, particularly in this time when, race has become, this national conversation in a way and on a stage and with a kind of almost like volume that it has not had in previous, decades, I think. Mm-hmm. Not that race has not been talked about before, but I do feel like we are getting to kind of a fever pitch around, let's put the cards on the table. And so when you're doing something like that, a lot of stuff comes to the surface, and I think that the things that are coming to the surface can be a lot of weight, the types of conversations that are happening, the craziness, the continued, abuse, murder, disrespect, all of these things are coming up to the surface. And I think that, I want to, for me, Juneteenth, I want to continue to use it as a way of us reminding ourselves to center ourselves and reminding ourselves that as we push mm-hmm. the country to do better and be better, the weight of that, that's an emotional cost. That's a lot of emotional labor. That's a lot of physical, that's a lot of labor in all the spaces, in all the senses. Mm-hmm. And so for me, this is what I'm trying to infuse, Juneteenth with, is this idea that these things, as they come, as we continue to push, and we're exhausted at this point, we are, sick and tired of being sick and tired at this point, mm-hmm. here's, this is a respite. And what is a respite? What is a communal respite? Like, it is laughing, it is loving, it is, sharing, it is, dancing, it is the activities, it is just being present to ourselves. And so this year in particular, more specifically to your point, what I would want to add, and the theme that I am thinking about, I'm pretty sure that, the theme is right now I'm working on the idea of it being, this stamping it as we been here, and this idea of us recognizing that not only that we're here now, but we've been here. And so that is something that I want, you know, to bring into the activities and things that are happening this year. And I think that is important for us. You know, we have another thing that I do here is I'm part of this group called Africa's Daughters of the Diaspora. And we've been doing these monthly virtual conversations. And one of the things we did for Women's History Month that I initiated was interviewing matriarchs of the community, Black women who are, you know, generationally, you know, for the most part, you know, generationally, as in they and their parents and their children and grandchildren, you know, they are the families of Hudson, as it were. And we did this event, and I got to interview, you know, elders who, when I was growing up, you know, they were always my elder, but there wasn't much that I knew about them outside of, it was more peripheral because I was a kid, you know, so they're friends of my mother in that sense. And I knew that they, you know, that they were older and, you know, they had, you know, children and their children and I went to school and that kind of thing. But, you know, now that I'm adult, I understand the power and reverence of, you know, of them. And why it matters to, you know, uphold these, you know, their stories. And so for me, it kind of sparked in me like the idea of Juneteenth kind of taking that further. This idea that we've been here, you know, gentrification has changed Hudson in ways that, you know, for me, I would come home for college and I'd be like, yo, what happened to Warren Street? And then I go, you know, so every time I came home, Warren Street was like morphing into something that was started to, you know, it was always, you know, had a lot of antique stores for such a small, you know, working class town. But by the time, you know, I was in my early 20s, it started to have this other, you know, like almost like antiques on steroids shift. And then it moved into Columbia Street and Union Street and started to move further down Warren Street. And all of a sudden I started to see the way that, you know, Black folks, you know, started to seem to be displaced and move further, you know, further to the right and further down street. And all of a sudden I'm not seeing us around town as much as I used to, and, you know, and that kind of thing. And it's something that a lot of cities are dealing with, you know, in terms of gentrification. And but for me, when I moved back here, I knew I wanted to say something about that or do something about that. And so for me, this year's Juneteenth, you know, this idea of we've been here, and we are here, is something that, you know, really sits in my soul to want to love up on us in that particular way, given the situation of the housing and the business structure and the degree to which, you know, where are the Black businesses here outside of, you know, Miss Paulette's? Where, you know, I think there's a sister who has a hair store who just opened up last year that I met. But there aren't too many, not that there ever were a lot of Black businesses, you know, in general, but just thinking about our presence in the community of Hudson. And I'm thinking about, yeah, using Juneteenth as a way of like us remembering, like, we here, we've been here. And to that degree, those are the things I want to infuse this year.
Well, you know, one of the things in our, we get into some pretty heavy, extensive conversations. And one of the things I really like in those conversations are the sensibility of you can't know where you're going if you don't understand where you've been. If you don't understand your past, it's very hard to be able to cogently set a course for your future, because you don't really appreciate the different things that and the wisdom that you should have gained by your prior experiences. So I like the way that you frame different kinds of initiatives in first sort of investigating, you know, this is what happened, and just kind of dissecting it and boiling that information down so that people really get a sense of what the foundation was laid and what others have done, and then being able to have a really productive conversation about moving forward. So in your hypothesis for this year premise, we've been here before. What does that signify? Is that sort of a call that we have an accumulated resiliency, in place to be able to weather these future storms?
Yes. in a sort of nutshell. And not so much that simply we've been here before, but just we've been here, you know, period. Right. You know, like we've been here as in, and when I mean by been here, like I been would be kind of is parenthetical, it's in parentheses. And so it's the we here. You know, and we kind of connecting the past to the present, and kind of a play on words, which probably makes more sense when you see it than when I say it out loud. But the because first I was thinking like we here, that's a very colloquial Black term, like we here, we in a building, kind of thing.
Right.
And so I was going with that, but I also wanted to connect the past, and so I put the word been in between the we here. To kind of connect that not just we're here now, but we've been here, and not in a been here like we've been here before, in that kind of like
like this is not like a
we're not in the negative, we're in a bad place and how do we move forward, but as in the like, you know, when you tag your wall, when you were young and you would, go to some place and you wanted to mark that you were there and you put, Randall was here. More of that sense, like we've been here. And that came out of, yes, this idea of, honoring the past and honoring our present. And wanting to connect those things together. And I have been I've been recently doing a lot of history, research on the history of, black folks in the Hudson Valley. And so I've been finding all of this information around, during enslavement, when did New York, somebody said to me recently or said something to the effect that they didn't know that there was slavery in New York. I knew it to be true, but I wanted to get very specific because I had, I think when I first moved here, found this book about, runaway slave notices in the Hudson Valley. And it's like, it's a really thick book and it just kind of illuminated how much slavery was happening and how much, the type of slavery that you think is only in the South was happening here in the North and specifically in the Hudson Valley. And so recently when I was like, well, what is, where, what counties, where around here? Like I wanted to paint the picture of, Hudson specifically. I wanted to see if I could find out, well, where is the trajectory? Even to the elders that I've been documented, but before them, like, where did the neighborhoods, I was trying to see like, around Bliss Towers, was it always, a Black neighborhood? What, like where were the shifts? Like I was really into getting deeply into the research in that way.
Right.
And when I did that, research and I found out some really interesting information, not in the city of Hudson yet. I haven't found like specifically the city of Hudson, but Columbia County, Dutchess County and Ulster County, like learning the numbers of the percentages of enslaved folks. I mean, like in the Kingston area was, I think I found that like 10% of the population in Kingston in the early 1800s were enslaved folks, enslaved ancestors. And then 1 in 4, I think of every 1 in 4 white people who particularly were landowners, not that they would have to be wealthy, definitely the wealthy folks, but even some of the, smaller farms and merchants, it said that 1 in 4 people were enslaved in, I believe it was Dutchess County. So that,
did you find
really
anything
illuminated.
Did you find anything about Kinderhook in that, in your studies? Because
only when it so far just talks about Sojourner Truth, but not as much as like it I have not yet found Kinderhook's name to come up beyond connecting it to her.
Well, I know that in one of the Black Lives Matters events, there was, because there's footage of it, and there's a cemetery for slaves, but it's almost like a mass grave. And I only heard it anecdotally, and that's why I was asking you how
got
much
you. I know that Kingston what you knew has about discovered it. One.
But and you know, I think as you say, there is a lot of talk about the Underground Railroad and those activities of people coming through New York and heading to Canada. There's not as much documentation about the actual participation that New York had in slavery, which did end just before the Civil War. So
right, it was like 1827 or something like that. And New York, I believe, or was it between New York and New Jersey, one of them were the last, like, northern state.
Yeah,
it went slavery. Mm-hmm.
And so, as we're talking about, it's important to know as you're striving to understand your place, and especially now in America where there's, you know, I think young people may have really a hard time processing the sort of notion that we belong, that, you know, that
exactly,
that, you know, you're here, as you say, you know, we're here and we belong here, like we're here and we're part of this fabric, and we've been part of this fabric for a long time. And people don't talk about, you know, Crispus Attucks, you know, the first black person to die. I think it might be the first person, I don't think it was actually the first person, but one of the early few people to die in the Revolutionary War. Like, we've been part of the fabric and fighting for this country since its inception, and enriching this country, and enriching the economy, building the economy, and not even being having a stake in the economy that we're building. So we've been part of this movement, this country, and even though we haven't benefited fairly or equitably, we do belong and have a fixed place. And I think it's tough as young people see that and see the marches and the speeches and the hateful things that are said that make it seem like we are not, you know, equal and valued participators in this economy and in this nation.
Yes, yeah, definitely. And I think that, you know, not just even not the young people alone, I think that a lot of adults also, you know, young people may have, because they're so young and haven't experienced a lot of life just yet, you know, are coming of age and struggling to belong just as a young person. And then if, you know, if you're a black body and you're brown body, trying to come of age and, you know, find a sense of belonging in it, you know, as most humans of their age are trying to do, and then do that in a body that is deemed, you know, public enemy upon birth, you know, that's an added weight of trying to find belonging. And so that when you're, and depending on, you know, the capacity of your family and your community, and your, your environment to reinforce a sense of belonging, when you don't have that, then you become an adult who needs to also learn or be reminded that you belong.
Right.
And I think that is something that is cross-generational and is ongoing and is part of, you know, our, you know, there's a saying, like, our existence is our resistance. You know, just being alive, just us being alive is resisting. Just having, you know, just being in your joy is resisting. Just, you know, just being, you know, and belonging, just deciding or just finding or discovering that you belong, getting to that nugget of beauty within yourself, you know, which is really sad that's what you have to spend your human journey on, is reminding yourself that you belong. I think that is sad, and that's not, you know, every place in the world, but that is something that I think is one of the, you know, the toxic, you know, effects of the U.S. project in what it is at this, you know, what it has been until, you know, because it doesn't want to deal and reckon with its past. And so, yeah, that sense of belonging and understanding that past. And I don't want to, it's not to bring, you know, for me, understanding that past for me is not for the sake of, like, you know, wagging my finger in white people's faces. Like, you know, I want to, you know, for me, that's that, you know, finding these things out is just like, who were our people and what did they do to get free? And then what did they do with that, you know, so-called freedom, right? Because we're still working on liberation and freedom in 2021. But what did they do in an 1800s context of freedom? And what did they do in a 1900s context of freedom? And what did they do in a 20th, you know, century context of freedom? And how can we present that in a way for, you know, us, including our young people, but for all of us to, like, yeah, remind yourself, you know, even personally, sometimes you got to remind yourself of, you know, where you've come, you know, and say, oh, yeah, you know, you're so busy in the, you know, in the weeds, sometimes you forget how far you've come.
And absolutely.
So I want the, you know, for me, that research is centered in, you know, how far have we come? How do we even know how far we've come if we don't know that we came? You know, like, where did we come from? You know, it's the, you know, the transatlantic slave trade, you know, that's, you know, the one from, you know, overseas from Africa is one aspect that New York is deeply, you know, invested and was built on top of. The part of the slave trade that people like to talk about in terms of the migration north or people getting free from the south, that was after, like, the transatlantic slave trade was, you know, rendered, you know, like, you know, I don't know what the law term is, but when it ended that you couldn't bring enslaved people over on ships, then there was a robust domestic slave trade, right, from the north to the south, and then us getting free and running back to the north, you know. But yes, the only way we got south was through the north. We didn't, you know, those ships didn't land on Florida. They landed in New York. You know, they landed on the coast, in the northeast coast. And then they went south, you know. And they didn't all go south. Some of them stayed. So understanding that New York was one of, like, you know, ground zeros, you know, that, you know, that matters, and it matters in us piecing ourselves back together, you know.
Well, as you said, you know, that I think that people lose sight of the atrocities that slavery wrought, and also the complicity of so many institutions and the entire government. This wasn't just a few rogue people that put this together. This was a system. It was a system of life and governance, and it was purposely designed to disenfranchise Black people and to give them such a limited role and really execute just powerlessness and keep a group of people just servile. And I think when I think about the Emancipation Proclamation, and I think some of the things that are the highlight of the document is not only being legal to be enslaved, but also the aspect of self-determination, you know, to make up your own mind about what you want to do and how you want to be and how you want to live. And I think bringing that up and even the remembrance, you know, like June 19th, to say you are free. You know, you might not have known it, and sometimes that journey is in your own mind. You may think that these shackles are around you that you don't really, that may not be in the way that you have them. But if you don't see that the shackles have been removed, you don't take advantage of all the things that you really should. You don't see the world as wide open as it really is.
Yeah, there's that aspect of it too, you know. So I think that there's, you know, there's several things in this pot of our unfolding, our continued unfolding. And, you know, I'm going to paraphrase, but there's something I heard, you know, I like to listen to all these talks and, you know, deep thinkers. And somebody said something that I thought was so profound. She said, we're still stealing ourselves to freedom. And when she was, because she said, you know, she said, you know, when you think about like people running away from slavery and this idea, when, you know, when you use language matters in a particular kind of way, and the way that she phrased it, when she said, you know, what you, when you ran away, you were stealing yourself because you were property.
Mm.
So that's, and, you know, and that was the offense by law, is it's like, you are stealing property. You know, how crazy is that? That me running means that I stole somebody's property. What a psychological, you know, I'm not gonna curse, but you know,
yes, exactly.
Right. That is like meant that, you know, like that is really depraved. You know, to have somebody think that they are stealing property when they decide that they want to go have their own freedom.
Just freedom, right? Just for the, you know.
Just freedom, that I just stole somebody's property. It's crazy. So when I, you know, and so there, you know, so there's levels to this, there's levels to this, you know, and there's, you know, and she was talking about this idea of like, you know, we're like what you're talking about in terms of like the freedom of the mind and recognizing like, you know, the you know, part of our healing process as descendants of enslaved people here is the mental part and the emotional part, the psychologicalness, right. The psychological being, right? And, you know, and how much work we're doing in our healing to try to free our mind and free our body, and the connection between, you know, and free our body in the sense of like the trauma that still lives in us, right? So there might be, you know, the door might be open, as it were, in a material sense, or it says on paper, I'm free. But we all know that most of the legal gains that we got, one, weren't given to us. We forced, fight, and did all the things.
Right, and have to continue to do
so. Until it became politically advantageous for this, you know, the system to agree with us. Not because they said, you know what, we wrong.
Right. This wasn't a crisis, right? Of conscience. They, you know, this was expediency.
It's an expediency, exactly.
On their part.
Yeah, exactly. This is expediency, not so much that, yeah, I didn't have this crisis of consciousness and God didn't like wake me up at night and make me feel, you know, recognize your humanity. And so, like, understanding that, you know, like, this is the, and being compassionate and sensitive with ourselves around that, like, this is us fighting for a thing. So not only fighting for something, and at the same time, you got to remind yourself to not get sucked into, you know, the disempowering aspects of fighting for a thing. And, you know, like, we're fighting on all fronts. And so there's levels to this, and the psychological freedom of recognizing, because, you know, I would imagine that in 1865, understanding that every law up until then was even like, it says it's on paper, but nobody in this town, nobody in the city, nobody in the state is going to abide by this. So you can think you free if you want to, but that ain't going down. You know what I mean?
Right. Like, and so then the trauma that came after that, the Jim Crow, the, you know, all the other mechanisms by
all
which
the black
people
codes, are, the all the things.
And exactly.
So like, yeah. So I feel like there's this, you know, there's just ways that, you know, we are, you know, I want to be gentle and loving on us. In the ways that we think about our past, and the way that we understand about our past, and the way that we move forward, because we're fighting on so many fronts at the same time. And it's incredibly hard for a free person to even remember that they're free in the United States, you know? And so I can't imagine, you know, that this is and I think that us, that mental freedom, that emotional freedom is gonna come through love and compassion. You know, I think that we have a way of wanting so much for ourselves that we get really hard on ourselves, mm-hmm. collectively speaking. And I think that we're at a place and a time where we need to recognize that that is, you know, that's part of the patriarchy and the masculinity of this place that says the way that you get there is through tough love, and this is what, you know, black people need to, you know, we're so hard on ourselves. And this is like, you know, we need to balance out that that with some, you know, some femininity. We need that divine feminine to be like, there has to be some nurture within this. And if we're not seeing the beauty of ourselves and seeing that within all of this, we are still here, and how beautiful and divine and how sacred that is. Even, you know, and some of this is like, we're just right. We're human beings like anybody else. We're going to get mad. We're going to be mean. We're going to do all of these things. But, you know, we're so hard on ourselves in certain ways that I think that, you know, again, what I want Juteam to be is this. I want it to have this lovingness. You know, it doesn't mean that we don't have self-development and ways to go. But I argue that it has to come with that divine feminine, with that idea that we need to love our way forward, not, you know, pick apart ourselves way forward, because we've been doing that and that's not getting us where we want to be. And I think in part is because we're so hard on ourselves that we are always constantly not seeing the beauty and the growth of ourselves within the context of all the things that we continuously fight every generation.
Right. And I concur. I think that your analysis of the situation and picking love as a starting point, just it makes sense as a human being, because there's so much healing that needs to be done, and that's really the place to start. Now your events are designed to bring joy, to bring unity, to bring purpose. We talked the other night about events that even when we talked about Kwanzaa, because a lot of the framework of our struggle and what we're trying to do and the positive things, you know, come from, and you made a great point about, you know, the words that we use and the way that we frame what we're trying to do. And we talked about how Kwanzaa has a lot of those words, a lot of that language built in,
yeah.
But it also has, you know, built in the language in a much more cultural context. And that by utilizing some of the concepts of Kwanzaa, I think it was 365, you know, but Kwanzaa all year long, that, you know, having that sort of framework, using a language that is specifically designed with our ancestral and infused with our ancestral components of community building, was going to be maybe perhaps one of the things integrated into some of the celebrations and festivities.
Yes, thank you for reminding me of that. Yeah, so yeah, my family, you know, we celebrate Kwanzaa very intensely, you know, and Kwanzaa 365 was what we talked about, and this idea that, you know, and I brought my, this past Kwanzaa, I brought my family, each family, I have my I live with my mom and my nephew across the street from me, my brother and his wife and children, and down the street from me is my sister, her husband, and their children. So we, like, you know, we're all in the same vicinity. And so, like, we celebrated Kwanzaa and the 7 days, you know, of Kwanzaa, we would rotate houses where we would, you know, do the candle lighting, and we would have an activity every day, a quote of the day. Like, we went in, you know, and at the end of the 7 days, I gave everybody a planner called Kwanzaa 365, and it's a yearly planner that someone had created. I found it on Etsy, and I thought it was really nice because it beckoned you to think about Kwanzaa as a yearly event. Or a yearly practice, I should say, not event, but a yearly practice, as in this is something that you live every day, and not, it's not just this 7-day holiday, you know, holiday season, but, like, you know, these are principles for life, not just for, you know, observance at a particular time in the year. And
that's a beautiful thing. It's truly a beautiful, not only just the 7 days, but just extracting that out and living your life among these principles is, I think, a completely doable and a great and a great exercise for people.
It is. It really is. And my sister pointed it out. Like, we have this reflection at the end of, you know, at the end of Kwanzaa, and, you know, it's kind of, one of the questions was, why do you celebrate it? you know, and asking each family member, you know, like, are we doing this because we're a family and, you know, we're Black and that's what we're supposed to do? Or, like, what is our personal reasons for celebrating Kwanzaa? And my sister said something that I, you know, found, I just really loved the way that she put it. And she was just like, what I really love about Kwanzaa is that it was these, that it was, because, you know, it was in the 60s when the Kwanzaa as a celebration, the principles were developed. And she said it was, you know, developed at a time when, you know, our elders and our ancestors were trying to develop a sense of self as a community. And she said, what I really love about it is the, about Kwanzaa and the principles is it's a way of life through a set of principles that that speak to me because it was a collective of people trying to develop a set of principles that they could all like live by. And I, you know, and it was just the way to, and I'm paraphrasing and not doing a great job of it, but she, you know, she said it really eloquently and, you know, to your point that, you know, the principles of Kwanzaa are so rooted, it's so rooted in our cultural place and space on Earth as African Americans. I would argue that we are an ethnicity and we have created ourselves out of, you know, this past.
Right.
And I think that the principles of Kwanzaa is an effort for us to develop principles within this, you know, creation of an ethnicity within this context to say this, while the country and everything has tried to make us assimilate into these things, here is us trying to decide for ourselves, which right. is a practice in self-determination, one of the Kwanzaa principles. And so the principles are, you know, like, yeah, they speak to what Juneteenth is about. It's infused. Because I practice Kwanzaa, me even, you know, putting all this work into making Juneteenth happen is me practicing Kwanzaa principles, right?
Absolutely.
And so, you know, and so for me, sometimes you just got to stop and say, oh, I'm doing this thing. I didn't know there was a term for it. And for me, Kwanzaa is something that is, we do these things. And Kwanzaa is simply the, you know, categorization and the labeling of things that we practice as a people.
Our time has run really fast. I don't see where the time has gone. But you're absolutely right. And it's wonderful when you just do it organically, like you didn't set out to do it, but it's just sort of being played out.
Yes.
How can
yes.
people find out more about Juneteenth and how to support yep. your efforts?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you for that. So, yeah, really quickly. So I'm pulling a team together. I've identified some people in the community who I know are doing ongoing, you know, beautiful work, who I've tapped to do some specific things, but I'm looking for a lot of things. Like, I really want, I want a lot of vendors, like, you know, all of the, you know, Black folks that are selling things, making things. I really want us to shine, and I want, you know, folks who want to vent to come out. There is
and how do they get a hold of you? And how can they get a hold of you?
You can get a hold of me through several ways. The Black Hudson Facebook group, which is just Google Black Hudson groups on Facebook. We have a page. You have to request it's a private page because, you know, it's for Black folks of not just Hudson City, but Hudson Valley. Like, we're really expanding to understand that. Because, like, right now I live in Philmont. So, like, we are, like, you know, encompassing Black people of the Columbia okay. County, you know. You can also email me at msjackson, that's missjackson.tanya, T-A-N-Y-A, @gmail.com. So you can reach me through my email. I'm on Instagram, but my Instagram page is private too. I would say the best ways is my email, missjackson.tanya@gmail.com, or you can message me on Facebook either through my name, Tanya Jackson, or through the Black Hudson page. If you sign up through the, if you request at the Black Hudson page and you're a Black person, I'll accept you, and, you know, we'll be sharing information there. So those are the ways that you can reach out to me.
Well, we're going to have you back on. This is always we always have such great conversations. I'm sorry that we kind of ran out of time a little bit, but I think we got it all in. And thank you, folks, for listening to another great show on WGXC 90.7. And this is Randall Martin, and with my guest here, Tanya Jackson. And I thank you very much for tuning in, and we will see you back next week. Thank you.
Thank you.